Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Our today's guest is the founder of iFood TV. It started as a channel specializing in videos of food recipes and then eventually expanded into other categories as well. He's going to talk to us today about how to build a profitable business without going all in with minimal risk. He is Vikrant Mathur. Vikrant, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Thank you, Rohit. Glad to be here.
So, Vikrant, tell me what was your first entrepreneurial experience?
My first entrepreneurial experience was actually way back in India when we were, you know, as a bunch of students, you know, some friends of mine, we kind of had this thing where we were, you know, copying and burning CDs, and, you know, sharing with friends. And, you know, we bought a DVD writer and we started kind of burning CDs and sharing with friends. That was kind of, I think, the first experience that I had.
So did you actually sell those CDs or were you doing it for fun? You did. Okay.
Yes. So, you know, it was a bunch of friends that were doing it. Okay. And it was a lot of fun. So, and then, you know, when I was here in the US, I, along with a friend of mine, we were listing books on Amazon and selling, you know, technical books that would typically be very expensive way back in 2003, 2004. So, and also again, back when I was in India, I did some work with, you know, essentially reselling books there as well. So, I've had, you know, kind of my share of failures or, you know.
What is the one that you can share during that time? What is a failure?
We actually, it was essentially a very kind of sophisticated system that we thought we would come up with for comic books. Essentially, for people who were interested in comic books, being able to share comic books in a way where you would accrue more points if you had more books and you were sharing more. It was essentially a way to, you know, get points which could then potentially be redeemed for essentially new comic books that you could go out and buy.
Okay, so it's like a reward system that we have here.
This was way back, I think, in 2000 maybe. Uh-huh. When I was in India. Okay. And we couldn't scale up, and you know, it was just, again, it was one of those things that we did as a hobby. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't really scale it up very well. I think it was primarily because of not being able to, you know, get the word out and have enough people who would be part of that community. And so, again, just, you know, learn some very basic lessons.
Did you lose money as well in that venture or just time?
Well, not very much. I mean, okay, it was you know, essentially trying to put together a community of people who would be passionate about comic books.
Got
and
it.
Then, you know, figuring out how, instead of going and buying expensive comic books, mm-hmm. you know, or old comic books that would mm-hmm. be hard to find, if we could, you know, share. And the more you shared, the more points you got, which mm-hmm. you could then eventually redeem to buy. So our idea was that we would eventually have like a store through which people
Got
could
it.
Buy books from so, us at a discount.
So that didn't work out. And you said, right? So I when I was looking through your profile in LinkedIn, I was thinking that the first entrepreneurial venture was actually iFood TV, and you had a couple of corporate jobs before that, but that is totally not true, right? So you had all the things going on the side in between.
Yeah, and even before we started working on iFood, actually, no, that's not right. While we were working at iFood, I was part of two startups where I was doing product management, both of which had successful exits. So I was, you know, even though I wasn't, like the first startup I kind of joined pretty late, but the second one I was I was you know, one of the early members. So
I see.
I got exposed to essentially being part of a smaller startup or a smaller company. Back when I was in Atlanta, when, you know, right after I graduated from grad school, I was part of a very small team, about 4 or 5 people, in the telecommunications space, which again was great experience, but kind of exposed me to the nuances of, you know, being in a smaller team environment, working with, you know, very little resources, and essentially, you know, essentially how to hustle to get things done.
Yeah. So apart from your main primary job of working in these startups, did you have any other side hustles going on at that time as well?
No, most of my hustles were actually in trying to find a job. So, you know, starting from when I graduated in India, my first job, which I got through campus placement but didn't quite really want to pursue with, I had to find another job fairly quickly, because, you know, I had, you know, I was in Bangalore, I'd been posted to Calcutta, and I didn't want to be in Calcutta. So I had about 3 months of training time in Bangalore, within which I had to find a job if I wanted to stay in Bangalore. So I had to hustle to essentially find my first job then. When I came to the US and I graduated from grad school in 2001, it was kind of the peak of the dot-com bust. And again, I was looking for a job in the telecom sector, which was, you know, the worst expected sector, you know, of all. And so, it took me a good about 9 to 10 months to find a job. But, you know, I was able to find a job by the time I graduated. I actually had 2 offers. One of which was this company in Atlanta. So most of, you know, the hustling has been kind of, you know, to get that next job.
Or got it. So it was in between jobs more than
right.
One after the other. So when did the idea for iPhone TV come about for you?
So I was actually at Microsoft, and my co-founder was also at Microsoft. We were part of an academy for college hires. It was essentially a group of college hires that Microsoft had, essentially freshly minted MBAs that were, you know, supposed to go through the leadership program and whatnot. So both I and my co-founder, we were part of that program. And for the first about, you know, 3 to 6 months, we really didn't have much to do. We were in Seattle a lot of time, and we were going through corporate presentations, you know, sitting through a lot of PowerPoints, which was not always the most exciting thing to do.
Yeah.
And so while we were doing that, we were, you know, kind of itching to do something interesting, something different. And one of the problems that we realized, you know, both he and I, just based on our experience, I was not very good at cooking by any means, and neither was he. And so one of the things that we realized was there are lots of people like us who, you know, who in our case come from India, have never ever cooked in the past before, because, you know, our moms would do it. And then once you get here, you have to cook by yourself. And so some people eat out, some people, you know, learn, and some people, I guess, depend on others to cook. So, you know, one of the things that we thought was, wouldn't it be nice if there was a place that people could go to and actually find recipes, all different types of recipes. So not just, you know, Indian cuisine, but, you know, Mexican, Italian, traditional American. And what we really wanted to do was wanted to have a video-based platform so that people could actually see what was being prepared rather than read through a bunch of text. So that's kind of how we got started.
So do you remember the day you had like this aha moment where you said, okay, this is like a great idea, I want to do
this?
Yeah,
you know, it really, there really wasn't an aha moment. I think, you know, we were looking at a whole bunch of different opportunities, and we wanted to have a video-based platform because, again, this is 2006. This is, you know, when YouTube was just taking off, it hadn't been acquired yet. Yeah. And we really felt back then that that video online is going to be the future, right? That's the future of media. That's how people are going to consume content. So we really wanted to do something in the video space. We didn't quite know what. We were thinking about, finance as a potential vertical. We were thinking about, health and fitness as a potential vertical. And food kind of hit home because, one, we could relate to the problem, right? It was a problem that we had faced ourselves, and we had gone, I remember reading through magazines and reading through cookbooks, recipes, and, not knowing what the terminology was or not really knowing how to prepare something. Oftentimes we would make something that would not look anything like the picture on the website, right?
Yeah.
And then you're like, I followed all the directions. Right. I followed all the steps and what happened? So we felt that there needed to be, a video-based platform. Food and cooking was a great category because, one, we had the problem that we could relate to.
Okay.
Two, as we started to do kind of, look more into it and do some research, we realized that cooking content has a great shelf life. So once you have a chicken tikka masala recipe today, you're not going to change that recipe for the next foreseeable future, right? So it's not like news where you need new content every single day.
It's evergreen.
It's evergreen.
Yeah.
It's very, very structured, right? So you can, you can break down the content and organize it in a very structured way. It's very global, right? So the chicken tikka masala recipe that you use here is very similar to what you would use in Europe or what you would use in Asia, right? So you don't have to change the content for different geographies. And so, so we just because of all of those reasons, we thought that food and cooking, and it's, it's such a big market. Everybody has to eat three times a day, right? So given just the scale and scope of things, given the shelf life of content, given how global it was, and, even from a revenue standpoint, if you look at most of the top advertisers on television, a lot of them are CPG companies. And so we felt that from a monetization standpoint also, it would do well.
Yeah.
So everything kind of, it was a hunch initially, and then as we started looking into it, everything kind of came together.
So what is the next thing you did? Like once you had the idea, what did you do with it?
Yeah. So my co-founder, he had some friends back in India. So, the first thing was to put together some sort of a basic platform through which we could upload video content, host it, stream it. So we figured out, what the technology was that we were going to be using. It had to be open source because we didn't have money for licenses. So once, we figured out what the technology was, we got in touch with, our friends who were interested, very motivated, and, excited to be part of our team and wanted to do something more meaningful than what their, regular daytime jobs required them to do. And so we found essentially a virtual team where we had people in London, people in India, people here in the US, essentially working together on different aspects of the platform.
Okay.
And
when did you first launch it?
I think we launched it in 2007.
2007? Actually, yeah. I'm on the time machine on the internet, and I'm looking at the December 2006 version, actually. Mm-hmm. And I mean, maybe I'm not trying to pick on the date here. So maybe you launched it in December 2006. But what I was amazed at on this website was that for the recipe of spicy rubbed turkey, there were 13,000 views in December 2006. How did you get so much traffic in the first month?
Well, there weren't very many... there weren't very many video websites back then, right? So one of the things was that we were probably, one of the, in our category, we were the first ones.
Okay.
And just, in terms of video
websites. How did you put it out there? How did 13,000 people know about it?
Well, so ReadWriteWeb did a story on us.
Okay.
You know, a lot of it was friends and family. Okay. And again, because, you know, it was a very interesting concept. See, the beauty with food is everybody relates to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, anybody that we would talk to, we could tell them about this and they could relate to it. And they would go visit the website, right? Because everybody eats, everybody has an interest, everybody, you know, has a favorite dish.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of it was word of mouth. We actually got a lot of publicity and PR in India. We were on CNN, we were on lots and lots of, you know, newspapers. And
sir, how did you get yourself up there? So
I think a lot of it was just, like I said, word of mouth. So I had friends working in the media industry in India. And, you know, whoever I spoke with, they were so intrigued with the idea. And, you know, people were just beginning to talk about YouTube and how it's growing and, you know, what the future of media is going to look like. And so there was a lot of interest, you know, amongst both tech journalists as well as, you know, traditional media journalists.
Yeah. Did you guys not consider YouTube as a competitor at that time?
No, because we felt that there was a place for YouTube, and, you know, there was a place for us. We felt that we were kind of, you know, YouTube's like the wild, wild west where anybody can upload content. There's a ton of stuff and it's not really regulated. What we wanted to do was we wanted to have a platform where you would find, you know, essentially high quality content organized and structured in a way that would facilitate discovery and consumption.
Okay.
So we were trying to, you know, essentially bring some order to the chaos of YouTube.
I see. Got it. So it was not until very late that you actually took it up full time, right? So
right.
Why is that? Can you explain more about that?
Yeah. So we, again, you know, if I, you know, go back, both I and my co-founder, we had graduated from business schools. We had over $100,000 in debt when we graduated. And, you know, we had both been recently married. And he had a green card, but I was on a visa. So we were, you know, both financially as well as socially not in a position to take on the risk of, you know, working on a startup, right? Mm-hmm. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to take that step, but take it in a very, very, I would say,
calculated way.
Calculated way, right?
Yeah.
Where, you know, again, you know, our wives wouldn't kill us for having made that decision. So what we chose to do is we chose to have our full-time jobs and, you know, do whatever we wanted to do during the full-time jobs, and then, you know, keep this kind of completely separate as a night and weekends project.
Okay.
And it effectively meant that we were working two jobs at one time, because, you know, we would come back home and we'd start working on this, and same on the weekend. So we had very little time for social activities, but what it also meant was that we were able to pursue our dream without having to leave our job and, you know, have that burden of, you know, essentially having to, you know, spend how many ever months before you get financing. And that also kind of relieved us from the pressures of raising venture capital, right? Because we were able to manage our costs in a way that we could sustain it.
Yeah. So how much did you guys have to put in? Yeah, you probably started development with your own money, right? You had to pay for the servers, for the developers.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So we had to put in, you know, tens of thousands of dollars initially.
Okay.
But again, because, you know, we were earning, it was not like we were digging into our savings, right? Mm-hmm. So the benefit was that we would make money at our full-time jobs, and then whatever, you know, we could save, we would essentially. So you know, we didn't have a lot of savings, but we were essentially investing into the business.
Yeah, yeah. Was it, were you scared to do that at all? Because even if it's not digging into the savings, still investing money, because at that time you don't know if it will take off, you don't know if it will make money in the future, and all those things, right? Like, what was going through your head?
No, I really never thought of it. I was never scared, because I always thought of it as education an experience more than anything else.
Okay.
So to me, you know, I was investing whatever I was investing. And even if it didn't take off, you know, I was learning so much doing whatever we were doing, that, you know, that by itself was worth all the investment that mm-hmm. I had put in. Mm-hmm. Right. So, you know, comparing to our daytime jobs that we had, at all the different companies, this was, you know, this was by far the most fulfilling mm-hmm. and, you know, it was the most enriching in terms of the experience that we were getting, the awareness that we were getting, you know, across all the different dimensions of the business. So,
yeah. So how about the emotional overwhelm that comes with starting your own company, right? So there is mm-hmm. a lot of emotional burden that comes right. with it. You need to do something right now and you are at, it's 8, 9 a.m. in the morning and you're at work and you can't do it. Right. How did you deal with those situations?
Yeah, I mean, I still have to deal with them. You know, I still sometimes get up in the night to send out an email that I forgot to send out before I went to bed. You know, it's just something that you have to get used to, I think.
Yeah.
I think over a period of time, you just learn how to manage it and different people have different ways of managing it. But you have to also, there are things that you have to do to kind of, you know, prevent that and manage that. And you just, you know, mm-hmm. each person learns how to do it for mm-hmm. themselves.
So not only were you able to do your full-time job at Microsoft while starting iFood, you even changed jobs and moved to another company within that time period, right?
Right.
How did that happen? And then it was, I was talking about Telefia, which is also a startup right. at that time.
Right.
So having like two startup jobs at the same time.
Right. Yeah, you just get really good at time management.
Okay.
You know? So I would just try to be as productive as I can
mm-hmm.
and figuring out how to make the most of your time.
Yeah.
So
what is one time management trick or principle or mindset that you can tell?
A lot of it is focus. It depends from person to person. I think a lot of it is focus, just, mm-hmm. you know, being cognizant of what's important, you know, not taking 20, 30 minute coffee breaks at work, you know, not having 2 hour lunch breaks at work, you know, making lists, notes, being more organized, being more structured, knowing exactly what you have to get done today and, you know, focusing on you know, getting those things done.
Okay.
I think that's the most basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, again, depending on the individual, you can kind of, you know, figure out how to be more productive. But those were some of the things that really helped me the most.
Okay. Okay. So before you move on to the times where you started doing it full time, anything else you want to mention about, you know, working full time and doing the job and not taking the complete risk? Anything else you want to mention in that lines?
Yeah, no, I think I would just say, listen, we didn't really plan it that way. There was a point in time when we wanted to raise venture capital. We spoke with a bunch of VC firms and it didn't happen. We came very close, but it didn't happen. You know, maybe if that had happened, things would have been very different. But I think one of the things that I have learned is venture capital is not the only way to start a business
mm-hmm.
or, you know, to be successful at one. I have seen examples of companies that get to 10, 15, $20 million run rate with, you know, almost no to very, very little investment. And so
how big were you when you reached out for venture capital or when you thought about venture capital funding?
We were about a year into the project.
Okay.
We maybe had like 100,000 uniques a month on okay. the website. So we were still fairly small.
Okay.
Very, very small, I would say.
Okay.
So.
And why did you decide not to take it at that time?
Because it was just too time consuming. It was very, very difficult. And it quite frankly would have added on more risk to the project because now you have somebody sitting on top of you, knocking on your head every quarter, asking you to produce results, right? So sometimes you cannot take the long-term view. It brings in a lot of discipline, but sometimes you cannot take the long-term view of, you know, where the company needs to be and how it needs to grow. And I personally think in our case, if we had raised venture capital, we probably would have shut down during the 2007-2008 housing crisis because, you know, we weren't growing as fast as, you know, VC firm would have expected us to grow. And, you know, things were very, very different. YouTube had become mainstream and that was the platform of choice. And so there were a lot of challenges. I think we were able to survive that downturn just because we didn't have essentially somebody sitting on the board asking us to show 40, 50% growth every single month.
Mm-hmm. So during those struggling times in 2008, what were you trying to do with the company? Were you just trying on sustaining mode, or were you trying to make changes to make it better, or what was going on?
Well, we were trying to grow.
Okay.
But the environment was such that we couldn't grow as fast. You know, advertising was really hard to come by. There was a very steep decline in ad spend. And so, you know, our revenue took a strong hit. Emotionally, it hurts too, right?
Yeah.
When you have a team of people and just the environment is not as supportive and conducive to what you're doing, then, you know, people start to question as to why they're doing this, right? And when shutting down is as easy as just saying, you know, no, because there were no strings attached, right? Everybody's working kind of in the spirit of working together as a team. It wasn't like, you know, people had their paychecks attached to it. So
yeah,
for somebody to quit, it was as simple as saying, you know, guys, I don't feel like, you know, we're making as much progress, and so I don't think this is the best utilization of time. And, you know, it would not, you know, we couldn't prevent that from happening. But luckily, our core team kind of stayed together, and we were able to.
And everyone was part-time also, right? Like,
yes, everybody was part-time.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Got it. And how did you decide to take that from a part-time venture to, like, full-time? So you quit your job and started doing it completely on its own, right?
Right. So what happened was in 2010, after the second startup that I was a part of, it got ExpertHub, it got acquired. I decided that I had the financial stability to take on that risk. Plus, from a business standpoint, we were doing well enough where we could actually draw a salary.
Okay.
And so,
what were your revenues back in 2010?
We were probably at maybe $500,000.
Okay.
Maybe $400,000.
And what were the sources of revenue? Is it ads?
Yeah, primarily advertising.
I see. So you decided to go at it full time. How different was it doing it full time versus what you were doing before that?
It wasn't much different. I mean, you know, I had more time now to do more things,
mm-hmm,
because I could work on it during the day. But it wasn't very different. So it wasn't a big change for me in any way. It didn't take me time to adapt or get used to.
Okay. But now you had time to spend with your family in the evenings.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Absolutely.
So I had some more personal time now.
I see.
To spare.
I see. And I was looking at the news articles for iFood TV.
Mm-hmm.
And around 2012, there are a lot of coverage, right? So
right,
what happened in 2012 that you got so much media attention?
So we actually, we transitioned our business from a purely web-based company focused on food and cooking related content to be more of a multi-platform technology company,
mm-hmm,
that's focused on, you know, a wide variety of different content categories.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we started to launch on connected TVs and smart TVs, platforms like Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Sony Smart TVs, Samsung Smart TVs, etc. And this is, you know, again, in 2011, 2012 is when we really started expanding, when there weren't very many apps and channels on these platforms. And we really were one of the early adopters of these technologies and platforms. I remember on Roku, when we launched, there were 25 channels on Roku, I think. And now there's over 2,000 channels on Roku. So that really was the big push.
How did you bump into it?
So what happened was, for iFood.tv, we wanted to make iFood.tv successful and, you know, be on all platforms, all devices. So we started off with a website in 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. And then when the iPhone came about, the App Store came about, we launched an app for iOS devices, subsequently for Android. And then we started looking into connected TVs, mm-hmm. again, because we wanted to be on all different devices. And what we noticed was the consumption on connected TV, both from a viewership standpoint as well as an engagement standpoint, was much, much higher than what it was on any of the other platforms, which initially took us by surprise, but it kind of eventually made sense. Because if you think about video, the form factor on which we are used to watching video for the longest amount of time is the television, right? Mm-hmm. We're used to watching TVs for hours and hours in a day, versus, you know, a desktop computer or a mobile phone. With TV, we saw really high engagement, really high viewership compared to web and mobile. And so we said, let's focus more on TVs. Mm-hmm. The quality of advertising that you can get, the rates that you can get are much higher on TVs versus the web and mobile. I so see. All of that put together, it was an accident, you know, just because we wanted to be on all different platforms. We launched an app for Roku and some of the other platforms, and we realized how well they were doing compared to all the other platforms. And so we said, let's just focus on this.
So it was more of an experimentation that led you to... Okay.
Right.
That's interesting.
Right.
That's interesting. So in 2012, I saw an article saying like your revenues were at $3 million. Right. What is it like now?
The $3 million revenue, it was... There was a lot of revenue that was coming in... through the advertising that we were selling on the website, right? Mm-hmm. So as I told you, we started off primarily as a web-based food-focused company. Mm-hmm. And that was the case for the longest period of time. What happened in between was, so with the website, most of our traffic, I would say about 80% of our traffic, was coming through search. Right? People going to Google and Yahoo and searching for a specific recipe, mm-hmm. hitting up on one of our URLs and then coming to our website. Mm-hmm. And so that was really the source of traffic for us, mm-hmm. right? And then in between, Google made a bunch of changes to its algorithm, right? Because of which a lot of websites lost traffic and we happened to lose, you know, traffic too. So as a result of that, our traffic, you know, dropped to about one third what it was before. And this is, you know,
and this happened in 2014?
No, this was before that. This was in 2012, I think.
Okay, okay.
2011, maybe. Okay. 10 or 11, I can't remember. But this is about the same time when we launched on connected TVs. We were starting to see the traction on connected TVs. Our web business, we realized, had a very serious dependency for traffic on some of these sources. And we realized that, you know, it's not a long-term sustainable business if you continue to have those dependencies. So we kind of transitioned to being more focused on connected TVs and smart TVs. And that's really where we are. And what we've also done is we've opened up the platform. So now, in addition to our owned and operated apps and channels like iFood TV, mm-hmm. We also work with 400 other content partners and power their apps and channels on these devices, right? So what we did was essentially took the platform and we kind of made it into a WordPress for video, mm-hmm. right? So that if somebody needs a Roku channel or a Fire TV channel or a Sony Smart TV channel, they can use our technology, they can use our platform, and we can help them with it.
So it's like a more B2B?
Yes.
I see. Okay. Okay. So are you on target for more than 5 million for this year? You would...
Not this year.
Okay.
Probably next year.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. I'll take that.
If we had our own ad sales team, we would do it this year.
Okay.
But we don't have our ad sales team. So we have to share our revenue with the ad networks.
I see. Okay, got it. And what is next for iFood TV and for you?
So, you know, we want to continue to grow. We want to we really are looking at, you know, the traditional TV industry and trying to figure out how we can kind of play a role within that landscape, right? So there's a lot of conversation about cord cutters, about millennials not watching TV, about, you know, TV viewership being down, people using devices like Roku and Amazon to consume content, move from a traditional time-shifted linear experience to a more video-on-demand experience. And so we're trying to figure out how we can be a part of that revolution where as people are transitioning from, you know, traditional linear TV to more of an on-demand experience, we essentially help them with the needs that they have in terms of content, right? So if all I watch is Animal Planet and History Channel, and I don't want to pay $120, $150 to Comcast, I want to use, you know, one of these devices to consume content, we are trying to figure out how can we be the source of the content that this consumer needs. Right? So how can we put together apps and channels that give you the content that you need, right? Okay. And that applies to kind of more mainstream content, and it also applies to niche content. Right. So we have, for example, some channels that we're launching, which are in the music and religious categories. So essentially, you know, for example, a gospel music channel or a religious, you know, bhajan or, you know, bhakti sangeet channel, you know, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Right. So with on demand, all of these opportunities now become available, and we can go after these micro niches and, you know, provide them the content that they need.
Yeah,
because now you can have 10,000 channels instead of 200 channels.
Yeah.
So we're trying to essentially figure out how we can be part of this, you know, overall, you know, media landscape, and how we can play a bigger role in it. How we can be a vertically integrated, you know, content and technology company that is enabling unique experiences for consumers, both one by providing them the content that they need, but two, also leveraging the core capabilities that an IP-based platform provides you so that you can now develop unique, engaging experiences that people would want out of a TV, which are not currently being delivered.
Good. So any other, any resources that you would like to mention that has helped you along the way?
Resources?
Like any books or any apps, I don't know, anything that you use on a regular basis?
So I would listen to Seth Godin. You know, he has a great podcast, and he has a bunch of books that he's written, Purple Cow being, you know, one of the most famous ones.
Yeah.
He's amazing in terms of, you know, how he delivers his message, how he communicates. And
what's your favorite book of Seth Godin?
I like Purple Cow the best. I think, you know, maybe it was the first one that I read.
Yeah.
But it really, it talks about how products need to be remarkable and how they need to differentiate. Blue Ocean Strategy is another book that I really like. As people think about innovation in product and
when you talked about micro niches, that's exactly what I was thinking about.
Right,
because there is no competition.
Right.
There is not too many players there, which is the concept behind the Blue Ocean Strategy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. There's another book that actually I'll let you know offline, but I can't remember now. But it's about problem solving, and it really helps people structure big complex problems into smaller, you know, subcomponents, and then figure out how to solve, you know, this big monolithic problem that sometimes seems humongous and hard to manage. And so the concepts are very, very simple. And if you read the book, you're like, yeah, obviously I know this, but, you know, as you kind of go through the examples that they have in the book, and they talk about, if you were to do this, how would you approach this problem, right? And just breaking it down into smaller components and then approaching each one, figuring out what the different variables are, what the different outcomes could be. It's very, very simple, but also very, very effective.
Yeah, that seems like a very relevant book for someone listening, but I would definitely like to know the name.
if you can sure. remember it.
So if anyone wants to connect with you online, what is the best way to do it?
My LinkedIn is probably the easiest way. Okay. I, you know, check my LinkedIn messages regularly, so that's probably the easiest.
Absolutely. Thank you, Vikrant. Thank you so much for doing this.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you, Rohit.
Thank you for tuning in. To get updates on latest episodes, make sure you subscribe with your email by going over to breakingtheborders.com. If you know anyone good as a guest, shoot me an email. I will reach out to the guest, get hold of them, and ask them all the questions that you have. My email is rohit@breakingtheborders.com. Thanks again and have an amazing day.